Love poem. We have plenty of matches in our house. We keep them on hand always. Currently, our favorite is Ohio Blue Tip. Though we used to prefer Diamond Brand, that was before we discovered Ohio Blue Tip matches. They are excellently packaged, sturdy little boxes with dark and light blue and white labels, with words lettered in the shape of a megaphone, as if to say even louder to the world, here is the most beautiful match in the world. It's 1.5-inch soft pine stem, capped by a grainy dark purple head. So sober, and furious and stubbornly ready to burst into flame. Lighting. Perhaps the cigarette of the woman you love. For the first time. And it was never really the same after that. All this will we give you. That is what you gave me. I become the cigarette, and you the match. Or I the match, and you the cigarette, blazing with kisses that smolder towards heaven.
Real Poets is an audio-only podcast that can also be visually read, like roses. Or when a director juxtaposes his or her most imposing reposes with characters, settings, and themes, composed of thrilling soundscapes, highest of stakes, and dreams. Hosted by a duo of real poets about real poets and the real poetry they've written and the films that have been written about them and their work.
Join us each week as we talk to another real poet with something to say and how a real poetry movie influenced them in some way. Then we each write a new poem inspired by our most recent viewing of the film and share it with all of you. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Real Poets. I'm Renzo del Castillo, and with me, as always, is Scott Raven.
Hello, hello, hello.
Today, I have the honor, the privilege, and the delight to introduce Chris Funero, at Chris the Poet. You may have seen him around the Miami scene, reading amazing poetry, typing up poems for you. Chris, how are you doing, brother?
I'm doing well.
Yeah. Now, before you added the poet, who Chris the Poet, were people aware that you were a poet?
Well, before I did Chris the Poet as my handle, I was doing cjp.oetry, which people could not remember when I told them, follow my Instagram. Christopher Jordan Pinedo is my full name. Yeah, people had told me, get a pen name or something like that. I felt a little weird about it, but I cycled through some different options that I was thinking about, and I found that Chris the Poet was just not taken, which I was surprised by. I also got the website, christhepoet.com. I usually go by Chris to everyone, and in that context, I'm Chris the Poet. In other contexts, I'm Chris the Teacher, Chris the Podcaster today.
Well, the film that we're talking about today, it's the name of a poem. The guy's name is a poem. And incidentally, the guy who stars in the poem, his name is what he does for a living. Not by chance, but we got an Adam Driver as a bus driver.
Adam bus driver.
Whether or not. Now, is Pinheiro your given last name?
Yeah, it's my surname, my dad's name, his family. They're Cuban. I've been trying to track down back a few generations. Were we or where were we in Spain? Presumably, it's a little hard with the whole Cuba situation.
Chris, tell me a little bit about your, for lack of a better term, your poetry origin story. When did poetry start playing a role in your life and help you develop from there to the point where now you write poetry for all of us?
Writing was something, it always came easy to me. But for many years, I kind of had this latent guilt that I should try to write. I should be writing or producing something in the sense, exploring that, and I'm not. I studied English literature at FIU, and I'm an English teacher. So it was some ways into being an English teacher where, you know, I kind of thought to myself, all right, well, I respect poetry a great deal. I feel like it's a bit of a blind spot for me besides, like, Shakespeare. So there was that side where I wanted to better serve my students and just round out my knowledge a little bit better. And also big breakup relationship of 5 years. We lived together and that came crashing down. And this section of poetry in my life starts sitting over on Surfside Beach with a fresh Moleskine journal, some raw shit that I had to process. This ongoing thing of finessing my writing up and reading. I try to always read widely. Renaissance poets sometimes, John Donne, Shakespeare. I have Spring and All with me. I have read it a few years ago, and I enjoyed it very much, and certain things stayed with me, and other aspects of it, half of it is like prose, sort of, and sometimes, I'll admit, hard for me to grasp completely the weight of what he's trying to communicate about imagination. But we do have this pithy saying, no ideas but in things, that's pretty clear. About a year ago, so I had been writing in my journal and maybe showing it to one friend, two friends. I started showing it to my girlfriend, Pat, who was very encouraging. And I decided I wanted to kind of get out there, see what's going on in Miami, because I had no idea what the poetry scene here was like, who else was doing it. I was also interested in maybe working my way towards publishing or submitting to journals, but I had no clue really. So I decided I'm going to make an Instagram, throwing shit out there. About a month after that, I was here at this lounge I hang out at with a typewriter. My first typewriter I bought for myself as a gift when I graduated from FIU. For years, it just gathered dust, and I felt comfortable here to bring it out as just another kind of enjoyable way to write, distraction-free. And a buddy said, hey, we sell coffee at the farmer's market across the street. It'd be cool if you brought that out, poetry and coffee. I had seen that people do busk with the typewriters. I had seen of it in New York. I wasn't sure if I could do it or if I would fold under pressure.
Were you familiar with the haiku guys and gals in New York and any particular typewriter poets out there?
Absolutely not.
Oh, okay.
I had just seen like a, maybe it was a PBS clip one time or New York mm-hmm. Times or something about a guy in Central Park. Oscar Fuentes, the Biscayne poet. I did come across one of his books at Bookleggers. I think it was Five Nights at the Betsy or something when he had the residency mm-hmm. at the Betsy Hotel.
Right, right. And yeah.
I read it and I just did a little post review and like tagged him. And he was like, oh my God, thank you, man. That's so cool. I'm glad you liked it. Hey, I have an event at Sweat Records, Tango and Poetry. Why don't you come out? And bring some fire. So that's how I got on stage for the first time, very nervously.
I'm a fan. Well, first of all, shout out to Kat. We're big fans of Kat here, and shout out to
yes.
Oscar, good friend of the pod, good friend of ours. Well, I'm a fan of your work. I think I've told you this before, and it's one of the reasons I'm a fan of your work is I can definitely tell that you're a man who reads. You're a man who I think reads voraciously. You pick up a lot of things, and you're also an educator, right? Could you tell me a little bit of how that love of learning plays into developing your own style as a poet?
So again, my background was studying English literature, reading a lot, analyzing texts, teaching my students how to do that, but a part of me always felt like I would love more than anything to get in on this game, to contribute my verse, right? and for a while, I did not know that I would write poetry per se. I, you know, imagined just as well that I would write fiction or what have you primarily, but it just kind of so happened that when I needed the writing, poetry is just kind of what came to me organically. I was in this emotional state and did not feel any necessity or ability to slowly lay out my arguments or rational thinking even. I just needed to spit things down on the page. As this has gone on in tandem with teaching, I would say no conflict for me there. I think my writing poetry has only strengthened my understanding of it and my ability to teach it, and teaching it in the classroom and really sinking your teeth into it gives you more ideas, as well as the classroom, you know, in of itself. Lots of things happen in the classroom that get you thinking and inspire things you want to write about.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you find there to be a conflict with what, like teaching poetry? You're an English professor, but the idea of teaching poetry to others, I've always found, you know, like on the high school level, it's you're teaching kind of the fundamentals. On the college level, it can be that you're in a room full of peers, right? You're kind of just trying to bolster the voice of whoever's in your class. So do you actively teach poetry as well, do you find? Or, you know, would you ever dare, you know, include your own poems? I don't think there's a problem with it in your teachings.
I don't think I would include my own poetry in my teachings unless the class was on the poetry of Christopher Panera.
One day soon.
I had a teacher, do you know, familiar with the poet Ted Berrigan?
I've heard the name, yeah.
He did the Postcard Poets and then Postcard Poems, and then this famous work called just the Sonnets. In any event, I had his son, and he would teach his dad's wife, his dad's ex-wife, as part of the curriculum. It's kind of a fun little vibe.
That's interesting. It's always interesting kind of learning about or tracing the poetic lineages. Right. Sometimes that's just a matter of who are the poets in one city or part of one movement, who inspired who was whose teacher. You're a Allen Ginsberg situation, which I was with this guy, who was with this guy, who was with this guy, who was with Walt Whitman.
I'm going to piggyback off Renzo's questions kind of a little bit. It feels to me, you know, I'm an admirer of your work already as well, that you have, you know, kind of like that poetry IV connected to you, right? Where there is an abundance within you trying to get out. What fuels that for you outside of the reading too? You mentioned the heartbreak, you mentioned that, but how are you able to kind of synthesize that? This will tie a little bit into the film, like, is it living poetically as well as the poetry that you read? Talk a little bit more, you know, you as a person and what else will fuel your writing?
I don't live as poetically as I'd like to. I think about, I think it's Wendell Berry. Essentially, I talk dirty and I'm just a mouth breathing dude like anyone else. Even though I can see a beautiful thing and say it's a beautiful thing, I'm not that per se. It's a strange thing. I heard one poet wrote about this idea of you're the poet while you're writing the poetry in that very act, in that moment, you know, something's happening. And when you're not there, you're like just some guy. Often that feels the case for me. Now, on the whole, and this is totally relative, but I mean, I've been told I think too much, overthink things too much. I have lots of stuff about in the world from either things I directly interact with or through social media, which is honestly negatively affecting me, just news and the constant stream of information that we are wired to. If you want to talk about an IV, that's one of them. So that's like a current that's running. And then, you know, I have my interactions with my people, the things going on in my personal life, and the reading. I mean, it all just kind of meshes together. And I'll have some days where it's a very emotional act, very raw. I have other days where it's totally not. I've written great things when I feel great, and I'm just very curious about something I've found in my words that I want to explore, or some, you know, metaphor that I thought of that I find fits something. Or, I mean, there are so many different ways into a poem these days, a lot of times, it'll be when I'm laying in bed already for like 10 minutes trying to get to sleep. Wait, the stream of thinking I just had, like, I need to write this down.
Let me ask you a question. After we start talking about Patterson, I want to challenge you on the notion of not living poetically enough, especially with the way the movie complicates the discussion. But I feel lucky that I'm here with two educators in a movie where the main character is an educated man. You can tell by all the books that he has and the way that he makes connections. At least that's what I infer. And also in a movie that celebrates William Carlos Williams, who was a physician, not to say obsessed, but maybe fascinated with the physical world, maybe a little detached in tone at times, but really putting emphasis on plain language, observation, and curiosity, right? A bit of the scientific method applied to poetry. And I want to know, what role has observation and curiosity played in your process? Because when I hear you perform, that's always at the top for me. Like, I always see like this observational, curious, it's that deep, right? As you said, like, this is, it is that deep, and it goes subterranean most of the time. So what does that play in your process?
Observation. I'm thinking about how Williams talks about in Spring and All, it says something about not carrying around all the observations you make in the day, like in a bag, and having them fall out, you know, like you, you can't match reality just, you know, taking a photograph of it or something. In his way of thinking, I guess, like, we have this internal world of imagination that meets and matches what is in the world, the universe, and we kind of construct and produce our perception or ordering of the empirically received impressions of the world. Again, I'm still trying to wrap my head around everything that he's getting at. For me, I will try to take time when I come across something in my daily life to not document it journalistically. I don't feel like I could do the thing justice, in a sense, trying to imitate it. It's like there's no poem better than a tree. Recently, I went to the ancient Spanish monastery. I will obviously include details and imagery to do with the place, but more so what I'm recording are my impressions, my thought tangents, what it's doing to me internally, kind of bartering and trading with the material of that physical place in order to order what's going on inside of me, or trying to flip it and look out, because I don't like to just write about me, myself. As important as that is, confessional poetry and all, I find it very important, and I love to try to write poetry about other things outside of myself. I wrote one about, I had a manuscript that was like 800 years old, made of sheepskin, lambskin, and each, like one lamb for two pages, you needed to like sacrifice a whole herd. That metaphor was just too juicy for me.
Yes. I hear that, writing outside of yourself. I know you recently, I think it was one of Oscar's birthday celebrations, you know, writing something for him. And I find that really wonderful to be able to write a poem for another poet, to write for other people in general. But when you can write it for a poet, they can appreciate kind of the depths of the language and experience that you're putting into it. For me, observation often is tied so much into performance. I'm hyper aware right before I get onto stage. I try to tap into what can I do to unify this crowd of so many people at a moment. What I somehow really want to work in, all right, what is the moment before the moment, like that I just experienced, that I can be present for, to then get into the poem for wherever it is. That can drive me crazy too, though, because then there's a moment, and then I have so many ideas of where I want to take something before even beginning sometimes. But then you have to find your way into that piece at that moment that you deliver it. Observation and curiosity through travel. But there also comes a point that for me, what's huge is letting the subconscious lead me, especially with all this information that is coming on into you. All right, I trust that that's there and it's going to come out, you know, however it landed on me. But there's just, you know, the me that's going to, you know, personalize it or relate it to the world. It's trusting that aspect of it is huge. How about for you, Renzo, just an observation?
I'm thinking about it right now in the William Carlos Williams frames, right? Like, so he sometimes used the ordinary to shock the reader into attention, right? Like, so much depends on the red wheelbarrow as an example. But with you guys, and when I think about my work, I think our observation isn't so much for irony or revelation. It's more about connection. At least that's how I perceive it, right? And I think when you read a poet's work, even if it's not introspective and it's about something else, you learn much more about the poet than you would have in conversation because of what they choose to focus on. For me, when it comes to curiosity and observation, I already, Scott, you and I have talked about this. I'm more of like that Bruce Lee school, right? I want to educate myself in as much of poetry as I can. I want to learn as much of it as I can, form, meter, rhyme, styles. And then I want to forget it. And then I want to react to see where I come from. Even in an interview, like right now, talking to Chris, trying to find out more about Chris, I want to come to this interview or podcast with ignorance and curiosity. I don't want to fill in the gaps. I don't want to come here and hear, like, and hear myself talk about things that I know in order to either make a good impression or fill in maybe silences that, as we've learned in poetry, don't necessarily have to be uncomfortable. They could feed the conversation. That ignorance and curiosity. Ignorance without curiosity is dangerous, right? But that ignorance and curiosity, I think, enhances that observation. And when I apply that to my process, it's how I try to go about it. I want to learn as much as I can. I want to go as deep as I can so that I can react without having to think of what tool I'm going to use. I want it to come naturally, to be a reflex of this foundation that I've built so that I can find my truth, who I am as a poet within each piece. It doesn't matter if it's a ballade. It doesn't matter if it's a Barzoletta. It doesn't matter if it's in the style of Emily Dickinson or William Carlos Williams, right? I want to be able to speak in their language, but be myself.
Carlos Williams, Williams Carlos Andres Gomez. Yeah.
WCW.
How she missed it.
The big boys play.
While you mentioned Red Wheelbarrow, I got up and I grabbed a, I don't know if you can see it. No. I grabbed a plum.
I guess the background makes it difficult.
I grabbed the plum from the icebox and I was going to eat it, but I just got Invisalign, so I don't know if I'm going to eat it. but it would be oh so delicious if I could.
To an old woman, my favorite William Carlos Williams poem. Like, I love that poem. It tastes so good to her, and that enjambment and that repetition. Oh, masterful for me. But anyway,
So you were hinting at it a little bit. I mean, with how does teaching, you know, fuel this? Do you feel is it necessary or for a poet to have another job that fuels their poetry? That fuels their poetry or let's say gives them an opportunity to create more poetry. Now he's a driver in this movie. Does that hinder or enhance him the amount that he can create? I mean, it provides plenty of opportunity throughout the film, of course, with the conversations that he's hearing. But to me, it's completely a profession that you can't write while you're doing, you know, you're writing in your head, but he can't actually write down while he's driving the poem. I mean, that takes concentration. You know, he doesn't even have a phone with which he can give voice notes on.
He doesn't want one. I want to give some quick notes about the movie. But before we do that, Chris, I just want to ask you, and Scott, I'm not going to forget your question. We're going to go right into it because that's what we were talking about, observation and curiosity. That's what he's doing throughout the film and the role that it plays. But Chris, tell us about what you're currently working on, any place where we can see you, anything like that, because I think that it's like the typewriter work that I've seen you doing recently seems incredibly fun. And I'm definitely going to hit that up next time I have an opportunity to.
I've been writing at Books and Books in Coconut Grove more frequently. I have my MFA starting in less than a month now. I'm just trying to stay active, show up to open mics, show up to events. I will be returning to the local VA hospital to do a poetry workshop, Frastic Poetry Workshop with the veterans, which I was able to do in June and was just the most awesome experience. I'd tell anyone if they want to keep up with me. My Instagram right now is the best place. I'm hoping to put out a little zine that I'll be printing soon. As time goes on, I'm hoping to work a little more in terms of submitting work to places and maybe compiling a manuscript. Oscar, performative as he is, advised me, like, hey, man, come on. It's good if you memorize one of your poems and then you can really perform it. I'm like, man, by the time I read this one, I've already written a bunch more. It's good advice. I should.
All right. So that is at Chris the Poet. You can follow him on Instagram at Chris the Poet. We are here at Real Poets, R-E-E-L Poets, with Renzo del Castillo, Scotty Too Hotty Raven. And at Chris the Poet, we are going to be talking about Patterson. Patterson is a film directed by Jim Jarmusch, came out 2016. Jarmusch came out 2016. It's over 7 days, a bus driver named Patterson in the city of Patterson, New Jersey, writes quiet observational poems inspired by the world around him in that city that shares his name. And I see this film exploring artistry, routine, the beauty of the everyday. We have Adam Driver as the main character. We have Golshifete Farahani plays Laura, I don't know if it's his wife or his girlfriend. It's definitely his loving and creative partner. He is a bit introverted. She dreams big, embraces visual art and music. Definitely somebody who's pushing him to share his poetry. You have Donnie, his supervisor at the bus depot, who seems to be a mirror of what Patterson could be if he gives into pessimism. You have Doc, who's the bartender at the local pub. He seems to be a supportive listener of him and keeps a wall of fame of everybody that came from the city of Patterson, which I think is something we can dig into. You also have Everett, who is, oh my God, the guy from The New Place, William Jackson Harper, this heartbroken romantic who performs monologues at a bar, who's kind of a foil for the love life Patterson has, which is quiet and seems fulfilling versus his loud declarations of love that seem to go nowhere. We have a Japanese poet who's going to play an important character later, Mary, the object of Everett's affection. And let's not forget Method Man, which we need to dive into that scene as well. And I just want to set it up for discussion now. Scott, could you please repeat your question so we can talk about the art of observation?
Yes. The occupation that Adam Driver, Patterson, is playing is a bus driver. Does this help or hinder his life as a poet? Is it necessary, or do you feel it helps for a poet to have another job in conjunction with poet that allows them to write more or fuels their poetry a little more? Like, I was a journalism major in school, and it was, you know, hard for me to find like a beat to write about because I love just writing. It was writing. And then, you know, poetry though became kind of my beat, you know, like, all right, I would find things to write about within the poetry world. You know, we're on a film podcast right now. I would write movie reviews and that sort of thing. So I'll throw that out to you. How in the movie and for you personally, an occupation, how that ties in to a life as a poet?
For me, teaching obviously coincides with poetry, not all the time, but in some sense, it can mentally exhaust you in a certain way, in a certain place where your poetry might come from. Although teaching can conversely also energize you, depending on your personality. Mm-hmm. And I have left situations in the classroom inspired and energized, you know, to put pen to paper. In the case, though, of having another job, and I don't think there are many poets who don't have jobs besides being a poet, but I think something like being a bus driver works very well in Clarendon. I have a lot of great thoughts when I'm driving. It's hypnotic at times. Writing is not something that I typically will spend like 8 hours doing. It comes to me in these like bursts. So I feel like Adam Driver in the film, he's always kind of priming himself. He's tending to that part of his mind and spirit where that creativity comes from. He's observing and seeing and listening to things all day, which is just as much part of the process of writing poetry as the actual writing. It's not just the moment you put pen to paper. There's a whole planning that goes into it as well. Like, I have one writer friend who wrote, he's like a sports journalist, and now he works in marketing, and he is of the school of don't turn your passion into work, or it will just become work. He's burnt out on all that. Hope to never go down that road, even though I am going into the more academic side of things. But so I don't think what Adam Driver's doing conflicts whatsoever. And of course, William Carlos Williams is a great example of someone who did both and made both work with each other. I forget if it was said in the movie or if I heard this in a video somewhere, that he wrote poems like he was treating patients and treated patients like he was writing poems.
That wasn't in the movie, but I've definitely heard that about WCW.
Right, right. I mean, if I'm gonna talk about being a bus driver though for a second, to me that would produce such anxiety of wielding such a large vehicle around the streets. Now, I know from doing a little research that that Adam Driver took, you know, bus lessons to be able to make it routine for him, which plays a key part. But like that idea would be hard, I guess. Yeah, if you don't have the roof down and to create that zen of, you know, I'm sure you're doing the same route, you know, over and over and over again. And it is kind of, yeah, there's such a structure to that allows you to really tap into the idiosyncrasies of the conversations that are aboard. But yeah, for me, a bus, I don't think I could manage.
So watching the movie, I found myself, I wouldn't say feeling anxiety, but there were point, like the movie I thought was going to go darker in certain points, but it didn't. So for example, the bus breaking down, I don't think they're gang members, but like the street kids driving in the car, talking to Patterson about his dog. The scene with Everett where he pulls out a gun and it ends up being a pellet, rubber like fake bullet. Pellet gun, yeah. Right? Air pellet gun.
False starts.
Yeah, there's a lot of false starts in things. For example, with Patterson, he's somebody that I, until the very second to last scenes in the movies, the first time I've heard him say no. He agrees to everything. He is incredibly passive. And I thought that was going to culminate in some sort of explosion, but it doesn't. It's just, this is all subtly under the surface. The bus doesn't blow up. There's no crashes. There's no actual bullets in the gun. Nobody gets shot because Everett can't find love or the love that he thinks that he wants. The little, one of my favorite scenes, it might be my favorite scene, the little girl, the one who's waiting outside the factory, who is a poet as well. And he stays with her to take care of her. He's just kind, right? But I just felt like, oh, he's going to explode. Something's going to happen. The dog is way too much. But it doesn't happen. I don't know what I'm trying to say here other than there's this tension that remains unresolved that may never have been tension at all. What do you guys make of that?
I did write about that. I was kind of doing a mix of like note-taking and verse early on. I said like the film has jumping off points that are never jumped from. Characters could misunderstand each other, run into trouble, interpersonal trouble, conflict. There are moments like these little knickknacks you typically find in the engine of a movie that get things going somewhere. Don't happen. People aren't very reactive. Everyone's very patient and able to communicate with each other. They're like non-starters. And I do think that we're meant to observe that they are there. They just don't take hold. The movie just continues without such conflicts.
Yeah. I mean, he remains calm so
through all those situations. In particular, he corrals the kids when the bus breaks down. I mean, you know, he in such a calm manner. There was some shot too of him having a military background too, right?
Yeah, former Marine, just like Adam Driver. Yeah,
right. And yeah, how he's able to kind of in the bar dissipate that so calmly and collectively, which. Yeah, plays into why a bus driver, yeah, he's able to do that so calmly. But there is, yeah, it's foreshadowing without it's like I guess yeah, Jordan Peele talked about it too. It's the antithesis of a scare, but there's not the boo. There's not the, you know, the monster jumping out where like he's attuned to like what's the release? The release is the poem, I guess, when it's written or when he's actually saying it out. That's the release to the tension.
So for example, that scene you mentioned where he stops the gun, I think he was tense. He was anxious. He's like, what? I'm no hero. And everybody else is like, hey, right. Good job, Patterson. Eh, you stopped the guy. If you bring this in, I'll kick your ass by disrupting my customers. But he seems to be the only one aware that it could have been a very different situation. At least that's the way that I read the scene.
Right. Well maybe how quickly he snaps into disarming him, the aftermath, he's feeling it a little bit. Yeah. But he is able to, yeah, take the gun out without a flinch.
There's a heaviness beneath the surface of like all these non-starters and moments that happen. And, you know, I did catch that he was a Marine. And he just had this very distressing situation. And again, everything's beneath the surface. It just keeps going along. But it definitely simmers.
You mentioned the scene when the bus breaks down too. And we'll tie this a little bit into his lack of phone, right? Yeah, him not having a phone. Does that make somebody more anxious or less anxious? You know, like... And amazing moment for me is when the 8-year or the 9-year-old girl is the one that lends him the phone to call for the bus. I had a big chuckle at that point where, yeah, he doesn't have a phone. But of course, yeah, every kid, of course, has one. More difficult when you're in a relationship, when one person has and one doesn't. But the relationship is presented, you know, in an idolized sort of way. That she seems to understand him so well, whether that's realistic or not. But
you're talking about his partner?
Yeah, his partners. Could either of you, yeah, you know, we would say it, but exist without a cell phone in your current living situation?
If I had to, of course I could exist without a cell phone. But realistically, that's because now I travel a lot. It's where I write down my poetry. It's where I get found. If I connect with people that need to, hello, I connect with people that need to reach me. I connect to Microsoft Teams to work with the team that I'm working with. So it would make it much more difficult, but can I survive without it? Yes. Am I going to have withdrawal? Yes, I definitely will have some withdrawal. Chris, I don't know how you feel about that.
And it might be a pretty zen way of being after the withdrawals. But for me, I use it for a lot of things. I'm kind of keyed in now to social media and I use the phone, right? It's my alarm, my map, my flashlight, my camera. You know, a lot of things. So my payment, I don't always have my wallet with me anymore.
Let me ask you guys a question because you touched upon it, Scott. I think we three, from what I know, are in supportive relationships. You mentioned Kat, Chris, Scott, your Den is a constant support in your life. Gurbet has become a great support for mine. And we have here in this movie this seemingly healthy relationship. Maybe there's some things that are left unsaid that we can delve into in a second. But between Laura and Patterson, but she is this extroverted, artistic force of nature that has to make changes every day. And he's this person who maintains his emotions internally. I think his big scene where he reveals anything is when he just looks at Marvin and very quietly says, "I don't like you, Marvin."
Yeah.
Right. And this is after that's set up after watching him every. Okay, so let's take a step back. The movie seems to be composed in a 7-stanza format, 7 days, right? And back to Monday. And every day being a stanza in terms of poetry. And every day you see his routine. He keeps pushing this mailbox. He keeps pushing this mailbox. He keeps walking this dog. This dog directs where he goes. He can't lead it. But he doesn't like pull it hard. He just seems like he's building up resentment. Later you find out that it's the dog who leaves every day and shoves the mailbox askew so that Patterson has to come in and sit it right. He ends up leaving his notebook out, something outside of his routine, leaves his notebook on the couch before he goes out on a date with his partner, his wife, his girlfriend. And Marvin chews up the book and he goes through maybe a depression, maybe an existential crisis, the preservation of his work being important to him at a time where maybe he didn't think it was. It was a moment of realization, and I can go into why I think that. And Patterson just had, that's where I see him kind of unravel and have moments of expression. So you have this person who, his wife or girlfriend, tells him every dream, vocalizes every thought, and he's somebody who is just runs internal. So my question is, as a partner, she seems very encouraging. He's encouraging to her, but is her encouragement helpful? Or does it pressure Patterson into a direction he doesn't want to go to? For example, documenting his poems, photocopying his poems at that point, which would have minimized the damage that Marvin ripping up his notebook would have caused, right? And the end of the sentence, if they had an argument, she would have been right in saying, hey, preserve your poems. There's more to that, which we'll get into later, which is an even big cathartic release. But right now, is her encouragement helpful?
I think she's supportive. It's coming from a place of love. And it's almost, I don't know. She understands, I think, that he's different, you know, but she might not always understand him. If, you know, like the depths of him or the wholeness of him, but she understands there's something special about him. If I think about relationships, it's great that, you know, they're both artists, you know, I would equate to being more poppy, we can say, and a different art form too, you know, something, you know, visual. Jimmy enjoys, you know, cupcake making and painting. And I think those type of partnerships can work very well, where it's not really a mirror, you know, it doesn't have like an ego attached to it. They can each be themselves within that relationship. And I think, yeah, that's where it works. I mean, they have a strong, you know, physical connection and an understanding that he needs time to write his poems. And occasionally she wants to really, you know, to hear one and, him recite one in the kitchen.
I think she's coming from a good place. She's more keyed in to the modern moment. She has the iPad and the phone. She wants to become a famous country singer. That's how she frames what she's doing. For Patterson, it seems like his getting from 0 to 1 is not so much, I want to become a famous poet of great acclaim or something. It's even being recognized as a poet or acknowledging himself as a poet. And there's something to be said for him. Like, for him, is it about the book of poetry, or is it about the practice and maintaining the zen of this life he's created, where he gets to live like he's in the 1950s, you know, which again, we don't know what happens. We don't know what happens before this week, besides that he was in the Marines. And that, I mean, like that moment with Everett where he like takes the gun and you see it in his eyes. He's like alarmed. He's a guy who has not just layers, but maybe sediments that have settled and maybe to his liking. He has his one beer every night. He keeps things simple. And there is a beauty to that. There's a beauty to not monetizing your work, to not even putting it out there, even though sometimes that could make us almost like cringe, like, oh, but we want to see you get famous and be successful and everyone heap mm-hmm. praise on you. Like, I want to feel it secondhand for you, guy who is a person in a movie and doesn't even exist. So the ending's very interesting. This man comes and, you know, Japanese, and William Carlos Williams is writing kind of in this imagist tradition, which Ezra Pound kind of started, I think, with like adopting haikus. He gives him the blank notebook, and that like zips up Patterson. It like sets him straight in orientation with, oh, okay, I have my thing now here, and I will just continue writing as if there were no hiccups. Of course, we don't know what will happen Tuesday. He might go postal or Monday or whatever.
Patterson, too. Yeah. Die harder.
You said a lot that I want to dive into, but just I want to finish the thought here. Patterson writes poetry, but he doesn't share it. I don't think he's less of a poet because he doesn't publish or perform. And he admires people that are performing, much as the Method Man cameo that we're going to talk about in a bit. And I see Laura's artistic ambition playing a good juxtaposition with Patterson's quiet devotion to his craft. But in the scene in the bar where he's talking to Doc and he's talking about the cell phone, Scott, that you brought up, he says, oh, she understands me. He's not even like, I don't know if she gets me sometimes or not. No, she gets me. Mm-hmm. She understands. She allows me to be me. And it's great because that's the scene right before Doc's wife comes in and gets really angry at him from taking money from a cookie jar. I don't know if it was for the chess tournament, or I don't know if Doc flirting with that other girl at the end of the bar. Again, maybe I'm looking for something more sinister. I don't know. The movie, I think it's a perfect homage to William Carlos Williams' poetry because it gives you observations, and whatever I'm putting into that, I think it's me. Maybe it was just a wife being really upset that he took the money from the cookie jar, and it's juxtaposed with Patterson saying, hey, no, she gets me. I'm very, you know, I'm happy with where I am. The only time he says no to anything she asks, when she wants to be a country singer, he teases her, but he supports her, right? He actually, I think, shows a good model for what a husband should idealize be. He seems to be a very idealized, even though she's the dreamer, he seems like he's the idealist. I will live without a cell phone. I will write this. I will find my life in simplicity. And I wanted to share with you guys one of my favorite quotes that came from that my grandma taught me. It came from Rabindranath Tagore, which he said, I will live my life straight, simple, like a reed flute, so that you may fill it with music. And I don't know if that's what Patterson is doing with his life. Every day it's a similar routine. He goes through it, he comes in, He gets up, takes a moment to look at his wife, hears her dreams, makes the coffee, goes out, writes in his notebook, asks Don, I believe, how he's doing. Don has a new story of how the mundane things are killing him, drives his bus, comes back, fixes the mailbox, interacts with his wife, hears about her day, sees something new completely changed in his home, takes Marvin for a walk, goes wherever Marvin wants, eventually makes it to the bar, sits down, drinks his beer, goes home, the day begins again. And in this routine that's set from Monday to Monday, we find moments of beauty like the little girl's poem, like Method Man's, I forget what his name is in the movie, his rap performance, the interaction with Everett at the very end, where it's like, you know what, I'm just going to get up and write again. That moment with the, I'm going to call him the poet from Osaka just because I feel like it's more epic, which maybe contradicts what this movie's going for, that it doesn't need to be epic. But the poet from Osaka just saying, no, you are a poet. No, I'm a bus driver. He still won't admit to himself that he's a poet, much less to this other poet. And he's saying, oh, a bus driver in Patterson? That's poetic. And he gives him this journal. And Chris, to what you were saying, what I found in that scene was, it's in the process of writing and creating that poetry is found. Maybe he doesn't need the fame, he doesn't need to share it, he doesn't need the recognition, but his life is not, when his notebook gets destroyed, he's questioning a lot of things, right? Like, maybe this does mean more to me. Maybe this is, where am I going to do now? And he's like, I was happy doing this. I was happy writing this. And to me, it's such a beautiful ending. So I don't know how you feel about that ending. or about anything that I said, but I do find that, at least in my life, I try to live by that quote. I try to keep everything as simple as possible so that I can have friends like Scott, like you, like my loved ones, fill my life with music. Does that resonate with you guys?
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful quote. You know, I just knew keep it simple, stupid was what I heard. The kiss method, as my dad had used always. You brought the more you talk too, though, like, I'm starting to see these characters not as people, but as poems, mm-hmm. each one representative of a poem. Patterson being representative of the poem Patterson. The girl being representative of youth poetry, you know, Method Man representing hip-hop culture and kind of just that style of poetry. They talk about, you know, their relationship, a Petrarchan sonnet. You could probably apply that to every character. And I know on this podcast, we like to talk a little bit about how poetry itself was used. For me, I kind of like, you know, the text, you know, the handwritten text written on on the screen with kind of like a little score, a little bit underneath. I mean, that really worked for me. I like when movies show the writers writing actually, and that was another way to actually do it. So speak on that. I know, Renzo, you and I talked a little bit about that when we did a workshop about you can love a city, can a city love you back? And I'd like to talk a little bit, I guess, you know, about Patterson as a city, a little bit too. Have any of you been there? I mean, I grew up in Jersey. I
will add that it's a question that I had, right? Place is a muse. The city of Patterson, New Jersey is central to this story, rich with poetic history. We have, you know, we've mentioned William Carlos Williams. Len Ginsberg was also mentioned. I think Gaetano Bresci was mentioned as well. And Patterson observes and listens. His environment shapes his verse. And I know Miami has influenced my poetry lately a hell of a lot. Chris, you're about to write, or you've been writing, an ode to Hialeah. Scott, like, you've come from New York to Miami, and I'm starting to see it come in your work. Chris, why don't you maybe delve into that a little bit? Like, how does an environment shape your verse?
I'm trying to remember where I learned about this from. It was impressed upon me, this idea that ourselves as writers, we are shaped by what we hear, the rhythms of our surroundings. For instance, Walt Whitman would have grown up hearing a lot of ministry, people under tents, preaching, and as such, she has a lot of certain kinds of repetition that are biblical in his writing. Some of those rhythms are used. So I think, you know, one of the first and foremost things would be the way people talk and the way we talk, the music we listen to, the conversations we hear about on the street, in our homes. That's also affected by what languages we speak or hear people speaking in, that affects our rhythms. And then there's the energy of the city. Is not a place that I feel I could write a national anthem for, like Francis Scott Key, something so somber and straight-faced. Like, it's a ridiculous place. And I could say that lovingly. It's high energy and bustling. It's loud and at times crass and crude, but there is a dignity beneath that exterior of working people and immigrants and exiles with, you know, tender stories and heartbreaks that they're nursing in this new place and the greater Miami as well. I write a lot of odes to Miami or things related to Miami when I write my people poetry on the typewriters. There's a lot of different corners and niches. I don't know how Patterson is, if it's more one kind of complete and of itself consistent place. Miami for me is, you know, large and has many different pockets of energy sloshing around at different tempos and tenors. I think it affects my writing. Of course, I've not lived elsewhere too much, and I can't say how my writing would be different if I grew up in New York or Patterson. Fun fact, Kat informed me that Patterson has, I think, the second highest Peruvian population in the United States.
Yes.
Happy field trip. Peruvian Independence Day.
Yeah, tomorrow. Tomorrow, my people will celebrate with delicious food.
We're talking 2 hours. Not tomorrow.
That keeps me informed.
I will definitely. Nice. I definitely will. What about you, Scott? How do you feel about place as identity? Because is Patterson the poet or is Patterson the place? Right? Like, who? What are we talking about here?
No, Patterson. Yeah, is the poem. I've often felt the home is the poem too. I mean, you know, I spent, previous to moving here, more of my life city to city to city to city than in any one spot. And now, you know, my life and my writing, though, is being shaped by my sense of home. And home is my family. And that is, you know, fueling a lot of my work. But it's also the communities, of course, with which I'm part of. And that can be, you know, the writing community. Fitness workout, you know, community, teaching, you know, that type of thing. But there's a lot of, I guess, Miami that I haven't seen as much because of where I'm at in my life now. Like I didn't wade through some of the other parts of Florida, where I guess I like to be able to do that, though, in a place. I think of, you know, John Hamm in Mad Men comes to mind for some reason, where, like, you know, he's working in this ad firm, but he's out there, you know, he's going into all these different environments that is fueling even his ad copy and that sort of stuff. So I'm comfortable enough in who I am, though, that I'd like to be able to, all right, I want to enter into some different realms outside of the realms with which, whether you're, I'm comfortable in or what have you, you know, like, all right, the club scene or whatever. I'm not a clubber, but to be able to go in there and to be able to, you know, comment on the cruise, you know, a cruise line, a ship, you know, these different aspects of the city that, because now I'm steeped into the literary world and the family world, I want to, dip my toe into some of these other aspects now that I'm living here for a while.
We talked about structure, or this, maybe like every day's a stanza or repetition or whatnot. What did you guys make of the twins? The first dream is, hey, I thought we had twins and then twin girls. And then he starts seeing twins everywhere, almost every day, the weekend being, you know, maybe like the week is five stanzas and then you have like refrains or whatever, right? Like the weekends are a bit different, but you see twins everywhere. What did that mean anything to you guys? Is it just coincidence? Is it intentional? Is it him affecting his reality, the way his reality affects his environment, the way his environment affects him? What did you guys think?
I'm a big fan of, and I didn't realize he was the same director. Jim Jarmusch has a film called Dead Man with Johnny Depp. And, you know, that's a film I could point to and say, wow, here's a real vibey movie with a lot of visual storytelling and symbolism. And even in that film, there is a moment with twin bounty hunters. And when they die, they have like, one has a white background and the other has like a black background. I was trying to trace what he was trying to communicate to us visually, because he was doing a lot. Like on the first Monday, you have a lot of right angles and triangles in the framing of things, if you kind of look at it. And this talk of twins, other days have like different shapes. You have the girlfriend wife who does all of this black and white yin and yang duality. It's something, you know, I feel one of those films you could kind of turn the volume off and trace some kind of through line. And you have, the twins, even people who aren't twins per se, at times are like paired up. Like you have the two guys playing chess in the bar in one scene where he like looks at the different corners of the room you have the two people where one lady's doing the jukebox. Another guy is facing away from her with his beer just drinking, but they take on a certain similar tone, or maybe because of the jukebox colors. You have the chessboard, black and white pieces, right? And he's the bartender says, I'm playing myself.
Mm-hmm.
So some kind of serious internalism, something with duality, with oscillations, with rhythms that I was trying to trace. And as far as the twins go, you know, I felt like it could have been an ending of the movie where it's like, we're having twins, right? Or we're pregnant. And in the beginning of the movie, there were references, in my opinion, visually to either, or and in terms of conversation, to either like fertility, consummation, or impotence. You have like the two guys talking about, I know what she wanted.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't talk to her yet, but I know what she wanted.
I had to do laundry. I couldn't stay. I had to wake up early.
When they're showing the board of Patterson people at one point, you have William Carlos Williams with his hands, and this is a man who delivers babies. Next to him is an astronaut woman holding her suit, and the way she's holding it looks like she's pregnant for Civil War.
Yeah.
And again, this is, I think you're right to say this movie is a poem and not like a narrative per se. And so we need to measure it and consider it in a different way, along a different rhythm, different standards. So, but he was very clearly, you know, throwing in these motifs a lot for us to look at.
Even on that wall, you have Abbott and Costello, right? Or you have like, duos. Right? So you have like all these dualities, right? But Scott, I want to pick your brain on this too, but I'll tell you something you said. Like I was watching this, and when I started seeing twins, you know, I forgot it was a Jim Jarmusch movie, and I thought it was like a David Lynch movie. I'm like, is he going to wake up and this is like his reality's all fake? Or because the Laura character borders on the surreal at times with the eccentricity, right? And then you have all of these twins popping up in all of these places. But then I remembered, you know, Jim Jarmusch is somebody who is a minimalist filmmaker whose films are idiosyncratic and unhurried. Like, I love Broken Flowers. I love Dead Man. My favorite, I mean, Patterson, I really like now, but Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai, I love that movie. Like that remake of Le Samurai with Forrest Whitaker instead of Alain Delon. Yeah, it's just great. And the way that he set up this film, like his style, this guy likes William Carlos Williams for sure. Or maybe E.E. Cummings. Like I for sure I can make that educated guess with this guy. For me, the way that duality played out, I thought we were about to move into surrealism, but I don't know how it played for you, Scott.
Sure. I love all the dual images that Chris had brought up, a lot that had gone past me. Now, when I think of duality, and we've discussed Hodorowski, a lot of his, and he plays so much with duality. And duality to me is often meaning opposites, you know, like a foil, the light and the dark, where twins, however, to me represent the same, whether they represent a facsimile. The twins that I've known, do you remember those G.I. Joe characters, the two twins? There was one that had like a scar on his face. They were two characters, two villains that could feel each other's pain, right?
Yeah.
That no matter where anybody was, they could feel the other person's pain. And I kept thinking of them throughout that. But you know, any twins that I know, it's a mirror, or they when they're younger, it's the same. It's not a duality. Another duality that I thought of though is the notebook, is the full notebook that gets a short and the empty notebook. And that being, could also be looked as the same. So even opposites can be looked at as the same. I knew two twins. I'm curious to know if any of you have had any, you know, relationships, friend relationships with twins and interactions with, in the fam. And yeah, what if that came into mind and some of the things you know just about twins personally? Because I grew up with two twins, best friends, the Brains, they were actually called, which is really kind of cool. It was B-R-A-I-N-E. And through childhood, you know, you couldn't tell them apart. When it got to college, and they did everything together, when they got to college, that's when their individual personalities started to show. One went to military school, one kind of just, you know, floundered for a bit, and eventually now they found their way back, and they're living in the same area. It was interesting. There was this one time, we were out and we were in this apartment complex, and it was this one occasion where I was guilty by association, where everybody I was with, they were up to some no good, and you know, a lot of them, you know, this was high school. They were, you know, smoking, drinking. And the Brain Brothers decided to spray paint their name on the speed bump inside this development. And for some reason, they said, don't worry, they're not going to know it's me. I didn't put the E on. And it was the most like boneheaded thing ever. But as they're driving that, cops rolled up and everybody had gotten we were all under 18. Parents had to come pick us up. And then we had to do community service in that actual development. But it's a prominent twin memory that I have with these two Brain Brothers.
My experience with twins is varied and deep. I've dated two separate girlfriends that have one had an identical twin, the other had a fraternal twin. My nephews are twins. I have twins in my family. I've been friends with multiple sets of twins. What I can tell you is, for me, seeing the twins in this movie about what lies beneath the surface, which is what I picked up from this film, I'm like, for me, it represented how different things can be. Because my nephews, Mason and Jason, yes, my sister named them that because she loves country music and she loves Michael Jordan. That's why they're Mason and Jason, MJ. Uh-huh. Mason looks just like my sister as a kid. Jason looks just like his dad, Chris, as a kid, and they're identical twins. They look the same, but their personalities are completely different. Mason is methodical, while Jason is explosive. They're very different. The other twins I've known are incredibly different, but they look the same. And to me, I can definitely see the way you read it, Scott, but to me, and I guess the way my life experience colored it is, these twins... Again, the repetition, the verse, the, you know, representative poetic structure, but the way that I see these pairs throughout, for me, said, hey, if you look deeper, it's not the same. Like, they're, if you think something is one thing or you make an assumption, challenge that assumption. That's the way that I read the twins.
I agree with you, but there is an emotional continuity between twins. That what I'm getting back with that is also what you hope a poem, how a poem falls upon people, where like you hear something and it's not the exact experience you have, but you're able to really tap into maybe what that person is feeling. That's where I think twins in poetry, I guess, relate.
So circle back around, you mentioned the word mirroring earlier, and I was just remembering that he framed a number of shots where Adam Driver is like in the mirror, or his wife is in the mirror, which I was, when he's in his like little study the first time and he's writing and she's like talking to him, you see just his head in the mirror, and it made me wonder, like, is he too much in the imaginary or not in the actual enough? He's in his head at this moment. He's on the other side. I can't say I fully made heads or tails of what he was trying to communicate with the twins. It could range from this matter of repetition, the emotional continuity I've heard of very much, that like twins have found each other after being separated by birth, and you know, some parents really make it a point to like separate them and have them do different activities, or they'll be like those kinds of twins who are like speaking at the same time, the same words. Yeah, and again, there was that aspect where I felt like there was an anticipation of some kind of conception, something to be born at the beginning of the film, but that it was not going to be actual children. And you have certain things that perhaps are born. You have his wife find her creative outlet. You have him reach that moment of processing and understanding as he receives this new notebook and is kind of brought into back into his fold, his equilibrium. But yeah, it's still simmering. I really finished the film like a little while before we started. I was watching it between last night and today. I was pausing it so much to take notes about things I was seeing.
Yeah.
Oh, there's so much. Yeah. I wanted to ask a little bit about lost work, unless we want to do that towards the end. Whether either of you have any experience with, have you written something that has been destroyed, lost, or forgotten? How you felt about that? Were you able to recover it? Were you able to recreate it? How did you respond in the aftermath of something that you had lost?
I lost a lot of my poems from high school that I tried to recreate, and it just never felt right. Just I was playing with form, and like there was one that was like around it goes, up it goes, like just trying to play with enjambment and form and rhythm and repetition and all that. I never quite got it right, but when I was in high school, I remember getting it right. One of the reasons that I lost, that's an example, but I've lost other works. And one of the reasons is that when I was going to go to Cambridge from grad school, and then I wasn't able to because of a lot of different reasons, I just stopped reading or writing poetry for a long time. Not reading I would always come back to, but I stopped creating because it was difficult for me until I think eventually about 3-4 years ago when my dad passed in 2020, and then I went through that whole journey with poetry, I realized that, and I think I've mentioned this before, right? In a society that is dictated by consumption, creation is a revolutionary act. It's a way to get connection, to get juices flowing, to get creativity flowing, to make something instead of tearing something down. That's when I found peace in the process. Instead of focusing on losing those poems, I'm glad that I wrote them because it led me to where I am today, where I'm much more productive and I have so much joy writing my poems, sharing it with you guys, workshopping them when I get a chance, collaborating on some pieces whenever we do get a chance to do that. I think that's why the ending of Patterson resonated so much for me. That, I mean, it's great to be recognized. I do want to put out good work or whatever's considered good, at least for me. Something to contribute to the literary history in verse. But I'm glad I write in the first place. I'm so grateful that I get a chance to continuously create. And that's only up to me and my imagination and my ability to use my hands or dictate, if that makes sense.
I can't recall having lost any major portion of my work. I'm not super organized, but it is all there, saved in my different junk drawers and document junk drawers. I like to, partly as a matter of necessity, believe that there are always more poems in me. When I started writing, and I see this with people who are fresh to writing, they are so possessive of the one poem that they're working on.
Yeah. Yes.
They're like, no, you don't understand. If this one isn't right, it's over. You know, and I'm like, you have to detach from them. They are all going to be reflections of different aspects of yourself. And it'll be a long time before you even like get your mental thumbprint down in your journal, you know, totally. It takes a number of different kinds of poems written in different mind states before you do that. Just as if, you know, it's ever totally done. I'm thankful for the poems that I've written. I do believe that they've brought me further along in terms of skill and ability or finding subject matter, you know, branching from one thing I've written to the next thing. I'm very sentimental, sometimes too much, but I like to remind myself of this and keep that attitude that there are always more poems in case that ever does happen, and I lose all of my poems. Nice. Or in case I get too caught up on, you know, what have I written, you know. And I feared this a little bit, getting caught up in, like, the poetry world. Other poets and readings and, ooh, a book, or submitting work. It's like, I need to remember to just have fun there on the page and do what I need to do and have that moment more than anything. That's what matters.
Yeah.
Curious, you being, you know, a typewriter poet, well, are you giving these poems, does it become a, if poetry falls in the forest, does it make a sound? You're taking a photograph of something you've created and giving to someone, but, or are you giving to them without ever maybe seeing that poem again?
I take photos of the poems and then I give them away. It's funny because we did this like typewriter poetry Olympics event like a year ago. Some friends, I brought out like six typewriters, and you know, it was just some whimsical fun. But one of my friends there is of a different opinion. I was like, I need to take a picture of this thing I've written. She's like, no, let's burn it. Let's make a fire and burn all of them. It's part of a ritual. Like, don't ever see it again. And I was like, how dare you? I need this. Like, but I also, I truly do respect where she was coming from and feel like that might be something to play with, you know, at some point in the future. But as it is, I take photos of all of my poems that I write for people, and then I let them take those one-of-a-kind poems, and I'm honored that people like hang them up in their houses and stuff like that. That's always super cool to me.
When I was doing it a little bit, how do you resist the urge to not repeat yourself within one of those poems thematically? Let's say you get a similar prompt. Will you ever go back to some of the same lines for another person that you're giving a poem to? And I'd say, by virtue of the mass of how much you might be doing in a day, there may be a recurring line that multiple people receive.
Does yeah, totally. I try to resist it.
Right.
If I can remember. As I've said, I don't memorize the poems per se, and I've written probably like 700 or more in the past year. I try to approach topics that I receive repeatedly, which I do. I love when someone comes and tells me, all right, your three words are banana, Van Gogh, and apocalypse. I'm like, oh, okay, let's take that somewhere. But most of the time it's love, happiness,
right,
and family. And, you know, I mean, for those, I mean, if I repeat something like the Biscayne poet, he told me he doesn't even consider those poems that he does in the same category as his other poems. And likewise, I maybe don't put the same kind of pressure on myself. It becomes this very instantaneous, spontaneous act that is directly inspired by the person, by that moment. You don't have time to sit around and structure something or like, you know, get more cute with it than you can right there in the moment. I usually end up starting my first line or something, and at that point I either know what it's going to be, or some other poems I get the sense from the first line like, oh, I need to find this one, and it will take me basically till the end of the page to like land it, get where I wanted to go or explore what I wanted to explore. And yeah, maybe if we lay out all those poems, I have some repetitions, but I really, truly always try to do something new because that keeps it interesting for me. And I'm always trying to put it down, you know, as best as I can. That's the fun for me.
I would find it hard pressed if we did do that, even going through your pictures like on Facebook or Instagram where you post them. I would be surprised if we find a lot of similarities, because what you're describing is, and I think our editor Flor Mireles calls it intuitive poetry, right? Like it's a very mindful exercise of being in the moment. Yes, it keeps you sharp. It can feed the skill that you use to write your poetry when you sit down and think about it, but you're just reacting to stimuli, right? So I would, you know what? I need a poem from you that way. I'll give you the word milkshake. Next event, I'll try to go and see you and give you the word milkshake, because I'm obsessed with Before Sunrise. And I love that scene where they just find a poet, a beggar in Vienna, but he's like, I'll write you a poem if you get, and you give me money. And he uses the word milkshake. And whenever I find a typewriter event, I always throw out the word milkshake. So that's what we'll do.
Do it while I'm there and planted to the seat and on the spot.
Yeah, that's how we're going to do it.
If I have an assignment and someone gives me 2 weeks, guess when I'm writing?
No. I'm going to go support you at one of these events. I really wanted to go to the Barnes & Noble one, but I've been out of town. But anyway, I know I think we have to start winding down, unfortunately. But I want to ask one question. Go to final thoughts, and then I want to share the poetry. You guys good with that?
Yeah.
The question is, because I really want to talk about the little girl Method Man and the poet from Osaka. What did you guys think of those three scenes, those interactions of Patterson with other poets, and what did they reveal about him, the character, anything? I can give you my thoughts, but I would really love to hear what you think. Great scenes.
With the little girl, yeah, that touched my heart. A great follow-up to the last movie we did. Shout-outs to Emily Dickinson. We did a Quiet Passion last week. And he called her a real poet. What a beautiful line. It reminiscent, you know, like, I do work extensively with, you know, that age group, performances, workshops, and that sort of thing, and hit it right on the head with, you know, they think all poems have to rhyme. She does rhyme. He tells her a little bit that she's doing assonance without her even realizing. And, you know, she has a voice, already. I heard that poem was written by Jim Jarmusch. which is kind of fun. But yeah, she delivers it great. Some wordplay, of course, within it. Definitely a touching scene, and I think helpful to young poets too, to youthful poets. And he deals with it, you know, wonderfully.
I didn't realize that was Method Man, which is very cool. I found it interesting that he was wearing plaid hat and I think scarf. Which again, we have a lot of this like duality imagery going on. So he had the red and black, a little different. And then when it zooms out, you see his pants are black and white, his shorts, whatever that means. And I love that he was spitting a verse having to do with Paul Laurence Dunbar, "We Wear the Mask."
Ah, that's right.
That poem was a little inside joke at work with some of my friends. The mask is slipping. those bars went hard. Yeah, it's like Patterson, maybe they are like a kind of mirror for him that provides him with a sort of validation. And I mean, it's like when you're able to give love to other people, to other things, especially when you see something of yourself in them or they're doing something like you do, sometimes it's easier to give love to them than it is, or recognition than it is to ourselves. So I do think it's all very positive, healthy interactions with him that he needs in, you know, these different lights, these different facets of himself. And I really love the man from Osaka, the poet from Osaka at the end. Uh-huh. He's kind of like a Obi-Wan Kenobi character. Right. I swear to God, I thought for a second there was a way he was walking away and like he stepped or turned. I thought I saw him dissolving into nothingness.
The like, Oracle. Yes. Yeah, I mean.
The Oracle, going away with the wind. He has set things right. He has returned to the poetry mojo with the blank page.
Yeah. Just, again, that it seems like that made me feel like it was going to go into the surreal, right? Like this man who comes from the Orient and just has all this wisdom and shows the mirror and says, like, what do you mean you're not a poet? Here. And just gives him that gift of a blank page. Again, it affected me because I've been given that gift. I've been given a notebook. I have so many notebooks. I have notebooks here, notebooks there. And I've been given that gift in a moment where I needed it, where I needed that reminder. So it's just such a touching scene, but I don't want to get into that. Scott, I am dying to know what you thought of the Method Man scene.
He touched upon it, that PLD, that poem, which I just remember hearing that for the first time in, I guess, high school too, and it being like a bridge to hip hop, you know, one of the early kind of bridges, you know, that I was like, oh, rap and hip hop actually, you know, yeah, like rhythm and poetry have that connective tissue. Yeah, I mean, another one of those where he's immersing himself in maybe a culture that he's not always around and taps right into it. That, you know, that's like part of my origin story of like, all right, you know, pairing up with a guy hugely into hip hop and me, you know, being from theater. I know Chris mentioned, you know, Shakespeare's influence, and I always get into these arguments with people, not arguments, but like on appropriation and whatnot. And like, you know, Shakespeare being the original MC, you know, going back to like, all right, I'll give creed to like the African griot storytellers, you know, with the djembe drums. But Shakespeare having that pivotal point that everybody's taken from everybody, you know, like all these styles are on the shoulders of everybody else. Yeah, you know, he dropped into some bars.
Only Palmer's Kiss, baby.
You have a transcript of it that we can hear it again. But I know I met Redman in Newark, New Jersey, who's not so much in the game anymore. But and you know, he like ends up popping around to kind of shows anymore. But he hasn't put out, you know, much stuff. And then Coffee and Cigarettes, he's in as well, right? That's another Jarmusch film. I don't know if either of you have seen, which I really enjoyed. There's RZA and GZA. RZA and SZA are in Coffee and Cigarettes with Bill Murray, but I'm not sure if Method Man's in it as well. Another Jim Jarmusch pick that I'd highly recommend. How about you, Renz?
I mentioned that the scene with the little girl is my favorite. I love that it shows so, it's again, how it develops his character. He's a protector. He seems to be able to speak. When he's so introverted, he seems to be able to speak and make it very comfortable for her and finds a way to relate to her as equals in terms of being poets. I thought it was a beautiful, beautiful film. I was surprised that the mom wasn't more concerned about him sitting down next to her while she was waiting. But again, maybe that's me living in Miami and having nephews, not wanting anybody to touch him, right? But it was a sweet scene.
Well, that's another like foreboding thing. Like, you think, is this inappropriate?
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it's
yeah.
Such a pure, yeah.
It's beautiful. Interaction. It's beautiful in that. And then to the point where the water falls over here like a water, you know, whatever. And he reads it to his wife and she says, that's beautiful. I love that scene. To me, it encapsulates him as a character. Maybe the thing that everything's going to be okay. I don't need to worry about tension. It's just things work out. Loved it. I don't know what else we could say about the poet from Osaka. Just again, it seems like a very Obi-Wan Kenobi scene. And beautiful, but the Method Man one for me was very impactful because, you know, he's not performing the full song, but he's seen practicing and muttering lines, right? And he keeps repeating, no ideas but in things, no ideas but in things. And this that reference to the Patterson poem from William Carlos Williams. But that scene is emblematic for me of what I got from this movie, which is poetry is everywhere, in a laundromat. I mentioned, Scott, while you stood up, that you know, I'm a big fan of Before Sunrise, and Before Sunrise they pass these windows that go into the lower floors in Austria, in Vienna, and you hear like classical music being played on a harpsichord. I go down, like walk down Biscayne, shout out to Oscar again, walk down Biscayne, and you'll hear people rapping, songs, like just spoken word performances. As I take my daily walks, it's painting, doing graffiti murals. It's great. And that scene with Method Man and him just saying, hey, look, you know, seeing Marvin is like, hey, man, what's up? What's up, little man? And he comes out, look, no, I was here walking my dog. And I stopped because I'm a big fan of what you're doing. I'm really enjoying what you're doing. He's like, oh, thank you. Just expressing to someone, just saying, hey, this thing that you are creating, It touched me, right? And I thought it was a beautiful scene with Method Man too. It was great. Poetry can be in a laundromat, which leads me to, I want to hear your final thoughts. And Chris, I I just want to challenge what you said, that you feel, you mentioned earlier in this podcast, that you feel you don't live very poetically, but we just spent about an hour and a half to 2 hours discussing how poetry exists in everyday life and the things that we do and how we live our life, right? Rabindranath Tagore, I will live my life straight, simple, like a reed flute, so that you may fill it with music. After this discussion, give me your final thoughts on Patterson, and do you still feel that way?
I love Patterson. Yeah, it makes me want to watch Ghost Dog and more Jim Jarmusch films now, to be honest. And I think Adam Driver was well cast. Think about how Patterson, in the book Patterson, is meant to be a giant. And I feel like Adam Driver has giant attributes about him. and he drives around a giant bus. So him or his bus, or them together, are the giant around Patterson dreaming. Yeah, it was a very rewarding movie for all of us poetry and literature heads. I was there like, he's got infinite chest and Consider the Lobster. Like, David Foster Wallace, what else does he have on his bookshelf? What does that say about him as a character? Ooh, a bus driver who likes Emily Dickinson. Or in an early scene, a guy reading Invisible Man on the bus. Very rewarding slice of life movie that was definitely something positive for me to watch now. The phone and social media, Reddit, the news, all of this stuff. It's just kind of an endless stream of crap that, you know, you're not solving it by being overwhelmed. When I say that I felt I don't live poetically, I'll qualify that then. I don't live like Patterson. I don't feel that I live the romantic poetry life that I have in my mind of spending hours in a morning slowly deliberating a flower or observing the birds, that I would like to be a little more like that and slow down a bit. I am, I guess, like a lot of my generation, going neurotic, looking at the phone and just on the move, and sometimes don't feel comfortable just settling, even though I feel very rewarded when I do manage to do so. So that's something I want to work on. And I think that that would affect my poetry, but conversely, everything is poetic. And if I'm like that, then I'm still writing poetry, but my poetry will have that quality, which I think at times it does. And maybe in the future my poetry changes, we'll see. But you can pull poetry from anywhere. I think any profession you have, any lifestyle, you can find cracks and crevices in your day to put down verses in your phone or to your laundry.
Yeah, and just appreciate the honesty of you still have the awareness that we all get caught up into that. There's so many that are so steeped into it that don't even have that they're in it anymore. But just to have that knows that it's so difficult to completely detach into that with other responsibilities. I saw this movie twice, once in the theater, and I can't really remember though the theatrical experience. I think I went alone to see it. It's not sticking in my mind when I saw it, and then I had revisited it. But it is a movie that you have to sit and kind of be with. I started to equate it to being the antithesis of Speed, the Keanu Speed. Yeah, which. It's just like a mirror or reverse to that, which is funny because, you know, I've been told that I resemble not Keanu and Speed, but John Wick. And then I was also told that I look like Adam Driver before at a school that I taught at for a while. So it's kind of funny though. Their figures, I guess they could look a little bit similar. Keanu, Wick and Driver.
I trust you to drive the bus. All right.
Thank you. Even though,
at whatever speed it has to be at.
Right on. Enjoyed this film, but more so enjoyed this conversation. Yeah. And you know, it makes me want to write too, as well. You know, yeah. which which is always a gift to be with that empty page.
Since The Color of Pomegranates, which was the first film we did, I think this film is the most that the one that felt the most like a poem to me, because I think Jarmusch really focuses on variation and repetition in his scenes and the way that the movie's structured and music and in art. And I think he wanted to make this little metaphor for life that every day is a variation of the day before or the day coming up. They're just variations, but there's beauty in that. Like there's a harmony in that. And because of that, I think this is the film that benefits most from rewatching. I love Dead Poets Society. Don't get me wrong. I watch that every day if I have to. But I think this film will benefit from multiple watches and see what maybe look into what the mirror means. And in that, to me, it seems like not a copy of, but an homage to William Carlos Williams and his style and the way that I definitely benefit from reading his poems multiple times. And they lend themselves to that. I mean, I know he has some epic poems like Patterson or what was it, Strange Sour Grapes or Strange Grapes. I forget the name of the other one. Just books, but his, like I mentioned, To an Old Lady, This Is Just to Say, The Red Wheelbarrow, like there's so much meaning and beauty to those things as you watch and rewatch. And I think this movie will benefit from that. And I'm happy that it's part of my repertoire now that I get to watch. And I was very happy to sit and discuss it with you guys. So we're going to end right now by reading poems. If you guys don't mind, I wanted to read Love Poem, so that people can get an idea of the type of poetry that happened in Patterson. And then Chris, if you'll share your poem, and then Scott, if you'll share the poem that was written in and around relating to Patterson, and then I'll share my own. But I do want to give a shout out to Ron Padgett or John Padgett. I don't know how to say his name. He is the poet that wrote all of the poems that Patterson wrote. And Scott, I have to agree, the way that this was represented on film, by far my favorite, not just the way that it came with the words and in cursive and you can read, but the way that he gets distracted and then he goes back and he starts from the beginning and he starts rereading it and starts writing and maybe making slight modifications. So I found that to be amazing. So I'm going to share Love Poem, and then Chris, if you'll please bless us with some of your art, sir. Love Poem. We have plenty of matches in our house. We keep them on hand always. Currently, our favorite brand is Ohio Blue Tip, though we used to prefer Diamond Brand. That was before we discovered Ohio Blue Tip matches. They are excellently packaged, sturdy little boxes with dark and light blue and white labels, with words lettered in the shape of a megaphone, as if to say even louder to the world, "Here is the most beautiful match in the world. It's 1.5 inch, soft pine stem capped by a grainy dark purple head, so sober and furious and stubbornly ready to burst into flame, lighting, perhaps, the cigarette of the woman you love for the first time, and it was never really the same after that. All this will we give you. That is what you gave me. I become the cigarette and you the match, or I the match and you the cigarette, blazing with kisses that smolder towards heaven." Great stuff, Ron. Thank you so much for writing that and us getting to enjoy it. So again, guys, this is the segment of the show where we read poems with my great co-host and our amazing guest based or inspired by what we discussed today. So Chris, please, what do you have to share?
Riverfall. Why go on? Why make your bed when you'll just get in again? Someone's grandma said, "You clean your ass, don't you? You'll do it again, won't you?" Why do we go on? For some plot? To reach some denouement? Some resolution of... Why establish tension? Tolerate it. Love? We love it. We love it. Why go to bed when we'll just get out again? Make it. Erase the evidence. Love the making. Love the unmaking. Time runs to catch the bus. To measure the bus. Time doesn't always do a great job of this. The driver does his job too. Good. I'm lighting matches as fast as I can, just to throw them away later. But now, I see their tips. Phosphorus. I see them. Soft pine curls. From a line into a curve. Living. What can you do? A good friend is not a mirror, but sits with me. We lament together that we will never see our own faces, but we will see each other's faces. But we will wait. We will keep trying. Because we are going without question. We are going. The hole in the dirt will wait for its seed. The seed will wait to grow the hole.
All right. I mean, I have a short one and then something else, but I just wrote, I have eaten all the puns from the vanilla icebox. Too cold, too cold. And now I'm also Eddie Murphy. That is to say, delirious. Here we go. Astronauts tied when marrying on the moon. Spacesuit filed when rocket builder sued Zoom. Armstrong, strong-armed Aldrin and delivers the line, holds one giant step aerobics class for all of mankind. Bus driver thrives on overheards and latches onto matches. Cook looks hungry, must not have saved a plate for herself. Left, 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 right, leftovers might help if she knew how she felt. The toaster's outspoken on how the microwave's oven's still broken, and the fridge is frozen while the stovetop's out smoking. Dishwasher now cleans satellites for more loot. Electrician punches the lights out and runs out of big ideas, feels no spark with his current squeeze and trips the circuit breaker, shocking his ex-wife when he leaves wires to become a match maker. Fisherwoman reels in a new catch. It's a smoked salmon now on the patch. She uses a clever fishing line on her mate and fashions a Dennis Rodman trading card as bait. A sea bass plays bass, but there's no way to hear how it sounds underwater. Don't call me daughter. Call me moisture. There's a 1 in 10,000 chance there's a pearl jammed in that oyster. Garbage man scores job in wealthy New England town, hunts for treasure on the daily, makes a documentary about his life with an Israeli. Oscar presents him his Oscar. Hand model gets the finger for breaking his pinky swear. Hitchhiker gets a thumbs down for stinky underwear. Internist scopes an intern asks him out. Marriage is not their bag, but they elope and build a house. Janitor goes goodwill hunting for a green blouse. At work, sweeps up winning sweepstakes ticket and cashes in before throwing out. Kinesiologist dines on a week's supply of muscles. Enters a soccer match and is admired for his hustle. Lifeguards drowning in Brussels as his bathtub overflows. He doesn't know Jack and he's rescued by Rose. Mystery shopper inadvertently solves the case of the missing roast beef sandwich in between Arby's investigation, takes on three dinners while on vacation. Nurse nurses her child in the wild, then draws blood with a red crayon on a tree. She tries to be positive, but she decides to just be. Oncologist is sent to prison, spends life in a cell. Puppeteer is used by the government to brainwash the children with abhorrent shenanigans. Quilt maker patches things up with his brother. An undercover agent working in the couch section at Raymore and Flanagan's. Rockstar loses the paper, uses a telescope to locate Dwayne Johnson. Synchronized swimming coach stages Imperial March for Sochi Olympics and the fix is in until Captain's Vader mask slips and falls. Translator encounters odd alien tongue and misconstrues message and empty blindness as merely mocking our canine kindness. Umpire attends 3 strikes in 2 days and gets tired out. Following week, he feels fine, so he walks to 4 balls with a Cinderella cosplayer who leaves her left cleat behind. Violinist into string theory feels there's a parallel universe. He chose the tuba. Thinking he's more clever than he is, reader can't understand why he didn't just delete what he said and start from here. Writer is almost finished, but feels he ran out of good ideas around the letter G. Decides to go back and edit. This time he deletes what doesn't pop and adds more before he stops. X-ray specialist writes biography of rays. The book's an utter failure, which is why he's an X-ray specialist and not a current ray specialist. Yodeler loses his voice in graduate school and never finds it. Zookeeper knows why the cage birds sing and tries to imply she owns the eye of the Tiger King. Her aardvarks arced out of there during last flood while her boars can't get up from the mud. Zookeeper, more like zoo loser.
Let the poem be, dear listeners.
Wait.
This movie affected me. I also wrote about waking up, Chris. I promise I didn't steal your prompt. This poem is called Glasses. It's an ekphrastic after Patterson in an homage to the style of William Carlos Williams. Glasses. My eyes open every morning 2 minutes before my alarm goes off. I turn to look at you, breathing unevenly. Behind you is the entirety of the left side of the bed. Your left arm drapes my chest, and I wonder if this is the happiest I'll be. My alarm goes off, and I reach for the glasses I don't need to see you. Another day begins. And that was Glasses.
Yes, there was one other poem that he wrote that we didn't talk about that ties in a little bit to yesterday. I like to think about other girls sometimes.
Oh, okay. Do you have it? I have the text right here if you want me to pull it up.
Yeah. Right. I like to think about other girls sometimes, but truth is, if you ever left me, I'd tear my heart out and never put it back. There will never be anyone like you.
How embarrassing.
Right.
It's called a pumpkin, right? It's pumpkin.
Pumpkin. But the reason why I brought it up is last night, Renzo did a poem that he had written for somebody else.
Prior to his
current relationship there. Now, it was all above board, but just that idea of that, to me, though, to be able, that can be the sign of a healthy relationship.
She helped me memorize it. I just want to shout out to Gurbet for helping me memorize it, even though whatever you made up in your head was probably not anything close to what reality was, but thank you for helping me memorize it.
I thought that was it takes a turn. It's a fun.
Yeah.
Spinderella. This was great.
Good
chats.
Thoroughly enjoyed this, Chris. I love talking to you. We definitely have to get another session going on. Always welcome back on the pod. Any movie you want to do, brother, just write in and we'll get you in here. But
maybe Dead Man, right? Yeah, we could do a Jarmusch follow-up, possibly.
We could. But Chris, one more time, you are at Chris the Poet. You have a lot of events coming up. You mentioned that the best way to follow you is on Instagram. Are there any other socials or anything else you'd like to promote?
No, I'm on TikTok with Chris the Poet as well. You can find me on Facebook if that's your poison. Besides that, just catch me in the streets, man. Me in the streets of Patterson, bro.
That's right.
I'm driving my bus. Catch me in the laundromats.
Vibing with Method Man.
A lot of brick walls in Patterson, actually. A lot of brick walls. Cobblestone, brick walls.
Very nice.
I'd say, just like the film demands multiple viewings, hopefully this episode people will listen to multiple times, because I think we've got some nuggets. And I hope, this be the one of many interactions with you, Chris. both poetically and non-poetically, but it probably will be poetically because everything we do ties to that.
It's poetic, exactly.
That's right, in some way.
Like right now, you look like John Wick Jesus with the light coming from behind you, so it's all good. There it is.
He really does.
Anyway, this has been Chris Pinedo, Chris the Poet. I am Renzo del Castillo. I am here as always with Scott Raven. What is your rap? You're mostly known by your rap name, right? What is it?
Which is Scott.
Three T's.
We're three T's.
And this has been Real Poets, guys. Go see Patterson. Really enjoyed it. Have a great night.
Peace.
Real Poets is produced and hosted by Renzo del Castillo and Scott Raven. Original music composed by Gabby Weitzenfeld. Episode art and visuals by the Real Poets team. New episodes come out every other Thursday. Hit subscribe, download the episode, and leave a review to help us grow. This has been a Real Poets production. And remember to always keep it real.